Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from WETS-FM and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Let me ask you something. Did you ever wonder what happened after Aaron Burr shot Alexander Hamilton? I mean, everybody's heard of the duel, right? The interview at Weehawken. You might even have Googled it and looked at some of the many reenactments of the duel that have gone on. And that's certainly what we remember about Aaron Burr, if we remember anything at all. But, you know, he wasn't the one who was shot. He walked away from that duel, and he had many decades of life ahead of him. Did you ever wonder what happened to him afterward? Well, I'll give you a hint. It started with the letter T, and the rest of the word was treason. Or at least I should say he was accused of treason. And there's our constitutional issue. Let me read you a part of the Constitution. Now, bear with me. It's a little bit long, but you'll get through it. Article 3, Section 3 of the Constitution, which is where we establish our judiciary and all the courts and judges, ends with this strange little section. Section 3, treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act or on confession in open court. But wait, there's more. The Congress shall have power to declare the punishment of treason, but no attainder of treason shall work corruption of blood or forfeiture except during the life of the person attainted. Wow. Two paragraphs in the Constitution specifically defining a particular crime. And I'll tell you something, folks, you can look as hard as you want. You're not going to find any other crimes defined in the Constitution. Why in the world would the drafters of the Constitution go into such detail about defining a crime? Well, as you may have guessed, it's because it's one of those crimes often was used back in jolly old England and in many other European nations and many nations throughout history in a very political, very corrupt way. And they wanted to be very sure that the crime of treason was not misused in our nation. Now, that became extremely important to Aaron Burr in the years following his infamous duel with Alexander Hamilton. Indeed, it's the subject of an entire book. A fellow by the name of David Stewart has written a marvelous new book called American Emperor, dealing with Aaron Burr's big adventures after his duel with Alexander Hamilton. I recently asked him why he'd written such a book.
Well, I practiced law for many years, doing sort of white-collar criminal defense, a lot of constitutional litigation, and about 7 years ago, I started trying to write books, and I've got three out, mostly on American history, and my most recent one is American Emperor, about Aaron Burr's Western Expedition.
Aaron Burr's Western Expedition. Now, most Americans, if they've heard anything about Aaron Burr, they've heard about the infamous duel with Alexander Hamilton. Did this all happen before or after that duel?
It's after the duel, and it's in large part fallout from the duel. We know Hamilton lost the duel. He died, but it's not at all clear that Burr won the duel. He really was ruined as a political figure after that. It was too notorious an episode to stand for office again. So he was
vice president at that time, right?
He was the sitting vice president, yes. He was the first of two vice presidents who have shot people. Dick Cheney was the other.
I hadn't thought about that. Okay.
What I like to say is at least Burr was aiming.
So Aaron Burr and Dick Cheney have something in common. But that is striking. I mean, if you think about that, that's like Joe Biden going out right now, getting in an argument with, Boehner, Speaker Boehner of the House, and the two of them go out to some island in the Hudson River and start, you know, blasting at each other. That wouldn't do much for Joe Biden's political career, even if he won the duel.
That's That's what Burr was able to establish.
Right. Definitively. Okay.
Yeah, it didn't help Hamilton, but it didn't help Burr either.
Okay. So pick up the story then. What happened after the duel and after the political fallout? What happened?
Well, he just didn't feel like he was done with sort of high office and leadership positions. He had great ambition, and he thought of himself as a natural leader, and he wanted to leave a tremendous footprint in history. And he really did expect to become president, and he clearly was not going to become president. So he was looking for a new place to do something great. And so he went out west. It's sort of an American tradition. When your life goes south, you go west. And he went out and really organized a remarkable expedition that seemed to me to have multiple alternative outcomes. He really did sort of play everything close to the vest. He was a fairly secretive, mysterious guy. And so he told different things to different people. But it does seem that he was attempting to certainly lead an invasion of Mexico and Spanish colonies in Mexico and Florida.
Whoa. He's going to lead an invasion of Spanish colonies in Mexico and Florida?
Yeah. I mean, this is 1805.
Right.
You know, the country's less than 20 years old. So, you know, there's not much, you know, it's all pretty new.
Right.
And, you know, Americans even then really liked land and wanted, you know, to expand. There was a strong expansionist tendency. We had just bought the Louisiana Purchase, which doubles the size of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this sort of combination of motives for invading Mexico. You could, of course, take their land. That would be good. You could free them from the Spanish oppression. That also is appealing, you know, sort of spreading democracy.
So it wouldn't be a war of invasion, but of liberation.
Yeah, we still go for that one.
Uh-huh.
And you could also, frankly, take their silver. Mexico was producing 2/3 of the world's silver at the time.
Right.
So there was a lot of upside, some people thought. And it was well known that the Spanish occupying forces were very feeble. This is the middle of the Napoleonic Wars. Spain is weak. They can't even get ships from Spain to Mexico because the British Navy is patrolling the Atlantic. So it was sort of easy pickings. At least that's what Burr thought. He also, though, seems to have had in mind really an insurrection of the French-speaking people in New Orleans and in the Louisiana lands, and even a secession of our own western states, Kentucky and Tennessee and Ohio. So he had a lot of ambition.
So he was going to go out into what was then the West, as you say, Kentucky, Tennessee, you know, the Ohio Valley, the Mississippi Valley, and he was actually going to try to recruit Americans to, it sounds like two things, to essentially secede from the Union and then to use that as a starting point to invade Spanish colonies.
That's exactly right, although it was the reverse sequence.
Oh, reverse sequence, okay.
Yeah, the notion is you invade, you recruit a private force.
Mm-hmm.
You know, lots of Americans out west were sort of unrooted people and looking for adventure. So you recruit a couple of thousand of those folks and get them armed. And then you also, he did make a connection with the head of of the United States Army, James Wilkinson, and to try to bring some of his soldiers along. And
so
then
he was trying
invasion.
To recruit some U.S. Army soldiers to join his private schemes.
You know, it's not that crisp.
Oh, okay.
It seems like if Wilkinson joined as a soldier, that would be great, although there did seem to be an expectation that Wilkinson would resign from the Army and would just bring a bunch of soldiers with him. And then they would join forces and invade Mexico. And that thing, matters would take their course. There would be a natural splitting of the country. At that time, the western states beyond the Appalachian Mountains really didn't have a lot to do with the eastern states. There was a big divide there.
Mm-hmm.
And they very much sort of were focused on the Mississippi River, the Ohio River, and economically they were dependent on getting goods through New Orleans. So there was this notion that if he could control New Orleans and, you know, win Mexico and Florida, that sort of the West would fall into his hands. And that was the sequence that he was after.
I see. Well, and certainly the latter part of that sequence, that the Western states falling into his hands, rather problematic for the president, President Jefferson, and the United States government at that time.
Yeah, indeed. And it's astonishing that, you know, he's less than a year out of office, and he's making this proposal as a former vice president of the United States. It is just an outrageous thing that he was trying to do.
Well, did this go beyond the idea and the talking and the conspiring phase and actually go into the action phase?
After a fashion. He was organizing it. He had one long trip out west about 6 months when he recruited a lot of people, and he ordered boats to be built, river boats, to carry them down the river, sufficient to carry 1,500 men. And then he went back east to sort of settle things out. He tried to get support from the British ambassador. He told them that he was going to lead this invasion of Mexico, and he wanted the British Navy to meet him in New Orleans. He wanted a fleet. He wanted 100,000 pounds. I mean, he was definitely getting underway. And then he went out west the second time to lead the expedition, and things started falling apart.
Well, before we get to the falling apart stage, you said go down the river. He must have started somewhere. What was his staging area?
Well, along the Ohio River in the Ohio area is where they begin, but they would be picking up men all the way down the rivers.
Mm-hmm.
So there were people as high as just outside of Pittsburgh in Beaver, Pennsylvania, who started. Then there were a bunch around Marietta, Ohio. There were more in Cincinnati, more in Louisville, and more where the Wabash comes into the Ohio, which is now Indiana. So it was set up to build as he went downriver.
Sort of a recruitment flotilla, then.
Yes, and he really did anticipate having, you know, 30, 35 boats filled with men. And when you think about it, the nation at this time had 3,000 soldiers. That was the entire U.S. Army. Well, mm-hmm. He was proposing to recruit, and the army, of course, was spread out over the whole country. He was proposing to have 1,500 men. That would have been a powerful force everywhere in the country. He would have been the dominant force wherever he was.
Wow.
And right before it was supposed to happen, something, the wheels started to come off. There was a federal prosecutor who tried to haul him up on charges. It didn't work, but it was a very, very damaging to his effort. There was a fellow back in Washington who issued a statement about what Burr had been trying to recruit him for, which was quite scandalous. He claimed that Burr said he was going to invade Washington, D.C. and throw Congress and the president out of office.
So there were allegations that Burr wasn't just going to stop out west. He was going to build his Western empire and then come back and attack the United States along the eastern seaboard?
Yes, and you know, I have to say that that's an outlier as an allegation. Mm-hmm. It's easy to be skeptical of it, you know, that if Burr actually said it, he might have been deep into his drink. yeah, really was not. He didn't seem to do anything to prepare for that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas he did a great deal to prepare for the Western expedition.
Right.
And, you know, he conspired, frankly, with General Wilkinson, who was head of the Army, to make this happen. And then finally Jefferson issues a proclamation saying there is this expedition getting underway and nobody should support it. You know, this is often called the Burr conspiracy, and I always try to avoid that term because it was so public. You know, it was in the newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
There were hundreds, even thousands of people who knew what Burr was doing. So it's not really what a conspiracy ought to be. A conspiracy ought to be secret.
Yeah.
And one of the remarkable things about it is the way the president, Thomas Jefferson, really paid no attention to it for over a year. You know, he was getting reports from out west, Aaron Burr's up to no good, he's raising an insurrection, he's raising a secession out here, and Jefferson did nothing.
Until he issued his proclamation.
Yeah, for 16 months he did nothing. Then he issues the proclamation, mm-hmm. and that really does sort of torpedo the expedition a good bit. Burr ends up on the river with 100 guys. That's all he's got. And they're going downriver. He's trying to recruit people. As they go down the Mississippi, he stops and tries to recruit some more soldiers in Missouri. He tries to recruit some more in Memphis. And he's hoping that Wilkinson will join him. Wilkinson is down in western Louisiana facing off with the Spaniards. And then when he finally gets down to that area, he discovers Wilkinson has double-crossed him and is now opposing him. And that's when he knows the jig is up. And he's confronted by a bunch of militia, and he does surrender himself, and he's brought back to stand trial for treason.
Well, this is just remarkable. So he's got a scheme that at first glance looks absolutely ridiculous, but then as you've explained it, you know, the times were very different then, and it was a wilderness to a great extent and also, you know, highly contested area. And I imagine there was a lot of anti-Spanish sentiment among the Americans in that region already. And so maybe he had a reasonable hope of recruiting people, and then, as you say, the wheels came off, and so now he's being charged with treason. Now, that's an interesting charge, because, you know, invading Mexico is certainly something the Mexicans would be offended by, but how does that amount to treason against the United States?
Well, you put your finger on that. There were really two charges that were brought against him. One was a violation of the Neutrality Act, and that statute made it illegal for Americans to make war against the country with whom the nation was at peace.
Okay.
And so he more obviously was trying to do that, although he didn't actually get there, so, you know, you can't say he did. Treason is a whole different thing. It's defined in the Constitution. The framers of the Constitution worried a lot about treason prosecutions being a tool of oppression for, you know, the British kings for centuries.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to make sure it was narrow. In order to commit treason, you have to give aid and comfort to an enemy, or you have to make war against the government. Levy war against the government is the term.
Right.
And you have to have two witnesses or a confession. And the two witnesses have to describe an overt act of treason. You know, no other crime is defined in the Constitution, but treason is, because the framers were so anxious that it not be abused. And
that's Article 3, that Section 3, right?
Sorry?
Article 3, Section 3, if you want to pull out your pocket Constitution, that's where this is defined, right?
I'll take your word for it. I
think so. I'm pulling out my pocket Constitution as we speak, and I'm virtually certain that's where it is. Yeah,
well,
exactly. Article 3, Section 3, it says, treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them, or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act, or on confession in open court. And then it goes on to say, the Congress shall have power to declare the punishment of treason, but no attainder of treason shall work corruption of blood or forfeiture except during the life of the person attainted. Now, that first part you've already pretty much explained. The second part about attainder of treason, corruption of blood, these are some legal terms that they just go on, various ways in which people who were convicted of treason by the king back in the old days not only were punished themselves, but their entire families were punished.
That's right. It was a British tradition that basically the entire line would be punished for the classic, the sins of the father would be visited upon the son.
Exactly. And so they were further limiting what people could do, or what the Congress of the United States could do to punish treason. So as you say, all of this was put into the Constitution. It's the only crime defined in the Constitution because the founders were concerned about the abuse of this particular statute or this particular crime. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm talking with author David Stewart about treason and about a fellow who was accused of it. His name was Aaron Burr. How in the world did Aaron Burr find himself in such trouble all the time? Maybe it had something to do with his ego. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and talk more about this very egotistical fellow, Aaron Burr. Stay tuned.
I gotta be someone who lives all of his life in superlative. When you're extraordinary, you got to do extraordinary things. The fact that I'm different is easy to see. So why doesn't anybody know it but me? I'm extraordinary. I need to do extraordinary things.
Well, I think it's time for a quiz.
I don't like quiz.
Shh, dear, don't cause a fuss. I'll have your quiz. I love it. I'm having quiz, 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 quiz.
Oh, my. Quiz. Stuart, what happened to you?
I don't know.
What is this in your coffee cup right now?
I had a Monty Python moment. I say, your dear quiz. Yes, we're going to have our constitutional quiz now. Kelly Carmichael from James Madison's Montpelier is here with me. And whom do we have on the line?
My name is Bob from Broomfield, Colorado.
Bob from Broomfield. Where is Broomfield, Colorado? I know it's in Colorado, but where in Colorado?
It's a suburb of Denver between Denver and Boulder, actually closer to Boulder.
I see. A nice place. A very nice place. Well, we're so happy you're with us today, Bob. So, Kelly, what do you got for Bob?
All right, Bob, I have a question for you. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Go ahead.
All right. Under the law, United States citizen may... under the law, United States citizens may work to change government policies by doing all of the following, except making public speeches, B, writing letters of protest, C, petitioning legislators, D, refusing to pay taxes, or E, joining an organization.
Well, I think this one sounds pretty easy, so just off the top of my head, I'm going to say that D is the thing that you're not allowed to do because I think you can't refuse to pay taxes based upon your beliefs.
Well, that's an interesting conclusion, but let's give old Bob a chance to think about it. So let's start again at the beginning, Kelly. Let's go through each one, and then Bob, I want you to tell us what you think about each answer choice. What
sure.
do we got here?
Okay.
Now?
And the question again is: under the United States, citizens may work to change government policies by doing all of the following, except, was it A, making public speeches?
Can you make public speeches?
I think these questions all have to do with the First Amendment to the Constitution, and I think under the First Amendment you have the right to make public speeches.
All right.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable. Okay, what about B?
B, writing letters of protest.
I think there may be some restrictions on that right. I don't believe you can make threats to people, but generally I believe you can write letters to people to try to influence policy.
Okay.
Bob's just sounding altogether too reasonable. All
yes.
right. What about C?
C, petitioning legislators.
Again, I believe that within reason you can do so. I think the First Amendment directly relates to the right to petition for redress of grievances.
Man. I don't know if we're going to be able to stump this guy. What was Andrew choice D?
D, refusing to pay taxes.
Can't we refuse to pay our taxes?
Well, as much as I might like to, I don't think that would be a good move for me personally.
Bob, you're from Colorado. You people hate taxes out there. What about the Boston Tea Party? Can't we just throw stuff into the river, into the harbor? Come on, taxes, we hate them. We can't just refuse?
We don't have any harbors in Colorado. We just don't have any harbors.
And so Bob is saying that we cannot refuse to pay taxes. Oh, are you sure? Is that your final answer?
What's E again?
E was joining an organization.
No, I think you can join. Again, there are probably some restrictions on what organizations you might join, but I think generally you can do so. So I'm going to stick with D.
Final
right.
answer?
D as in dog is my final answer.
All right, Bob.
Oh, well done. Well done indeed. Not only did you zero in on the correct answer, not only were you unshakable in your conviction, but you correctly identified the First Amendment as the source of I think, either all or most of the other rights that were identified in the other answer choices. So very, very well done. Even the relatively obscure First Amendment rights are the right to petition and the right to assemble. So well done, Bob.
Well, I had a great teacher along these lines.
Well, I'm so pleased to hear that. All righty.
Anything else, Kelly?
No, nice job, Bob. Congratulations.
Bob,
enjoy your T-shirt.
You get a T-shirt. You enjoy that.
Well, thank you very much.
All right.
I appreciate it, and had fun.
All right, bye. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm talking with author David Stewart, who's written about Aaron Burr and his big adventures after he shot and killed Alexander Hamilton. As we've been discussing, Aaron got himself into some tough scrapes, which wound up with him being accused of treason. All right, so again, how is Burr guilty of this?
Well, he got acquitted of it, so that's a great question.
So I guess he wasn't guilty of it, but why did they think that they could get him on treason if he really, I mean, again, his first objective was to invade these foreign countries, and maybe later he would have come back and tried to take over the western part of the United States. Then you've got a pretty clear case for treason, but why did they think they could get him at this stage when he was still just talking about going down and taking Florida and Mexico?
Yeah, the short answer is really that President Jefferson finally had gotten really angry, and he just wanted to nail Burr every which way. And so he, insisted that he be prosecuted for treason, even though the case was going to be very weak. Now, they also bungled the case in a couple of important ways, and they also ran up against the fact that Burr was able to cover up a lot of evidence. And a lot of the people who were close to him in this effort either refused to testify or couldn't testify because they had been indicted for treason also. So obviously they had no interest in testifying.
So, okay, well, before we get to that, though, and I know I asked you about, you know, why, how he could be guilty, essentially this was overreaching. Okay, Jefferson got angry. Jefferson decided, let's nail him with everything we've got. Treason came to mind, so they charged him with it. How did he – where did he actually get prosecuted? What give us – set the stage for us.
Yeah, you see, he had been, I mentioned he was hauled before a grand jury in Kentucky. They let him off, basically said invading Mexico sounded like a good idea to them. he got hauled in front of a grand jury when he reached Mississippi.
Right.
It was a territory at the time, but they hauled him for a grand jury there. Same outcome. Grand jury said, you know, Colonel Burr seems like a fine guy, and we don't know why you're persecuting him. So.
Right.
Jefferson decided he didn't want Burr tried out west, that those Westerners just were going to let him off. So he wanted to try him in Richmond, in Virginia, because he knew that the people there would take his side in this disagreement, that, you know, after all, they would be good, at the time they were called Republicans, they would be good Jeffersonian Republicans.
Right.
And indeed, he ended up with a jury of, you know, people who disliked Burr intensely. There were several jurors who protested that they shouldn't be forced to serve on the jury because they had said they thought Burr ought to be hanged. And
that's a pretty good reason not to seat someone as a juror. Let me just ask you this, though. It's another constitutional issue that simply has probably popped into a number of people's minds. Why wasn't this a violation of the Fifth Amendment's prohibition of double jeopardy? I mean, why he was just going from state to state and being charged with treason and the grand juries weren't indicting him? Why didn't jeopardy attach?
Well, jeopardy doesn't attach until the jury is sworn in, so the grand jury proceedings don't work against him.
Okay, so they can just keep trying to indict him from place to place until they finally find a grand jury that's willing to indict.
Right, and the Virginia grand jury did indict him.
Okay, so they're finally up in Richmond. The Virginia grand jury indicts him. They're able to seat a jury eventually, and then what happens?
Well, all hell breaks loose. It is our first trial of the century.
Right.
You know, you got a former vice president of the United States is facing hanging if he's convicted of treason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you think about what Fox News and CNN would do with that today, that'd be a good story.
I think it'd be bigger than OJ.
It might be.
I think it might be. When did this actually start, the trial in Richmond? Because we've had
It started in August of 1807.
Okay.
And it ran about a month. And Burr had an all-star defense team, wonderful lawyers. John Wickham of Richmond was a lawyer. He had two former delegates to the Constitutional Convention. He himself was actively engaged in his defense and, frankly, was the best lawyer in the room.
Mm-hmm.
The prosecutors were an extremely talented group. And we had the best judge in our history presiding because Chief Justice John Marshall heard the case. That was a time when the Supreme Court justices did what was called riding circuit, and they would go out into the country and hear trials. And Marshall, who was a Virginian, was responsible for Virginia, so every federal trial in Virginia happened before him. And when Jefferson decided he wanted his case tried, this case done in Virginia, he only got so far in figuring it out because he didn't think about the fact that it was going to be in front of Marshall, and Marshall hated him. So,
and vice versa.
Yeah, they did not get along.
Even though they were distant cousins, weren't they?
They were distant cousins. They had known each other for a long time. They were certainly political adversaries, and they did not admire each other.
Right. Marshall was an ardent Federalist, which was the party of Washington and Hamilton and Adams. And Jefferson, as you mentioned, was a Jeffersonian, appropriately enough, a Democratic Republican. And they had very different political views. We don't need to go into all of that now. But as you say, they were just ardent political rivals. They didn't like each other. So Jefferson might have gotten a good jury pool in Virginia, but he certainly did not get a friendly judge.
That's exactly right. And, you know, Marshall tried the case in a very active fashion. The provision of the Constitution that you read about the impeachment clause, treason clause, he took very seriously. You know, he'd had treason prosecutions before where it hadn't actually been applied. But he did, and he kept telling prosecutors, where are your overt acts of treason? And after 14 witnesses, they said, well, that's the best we've got. They had another 80 witnesses, but they didn't have anything more. So he stopped the trial and sent the case to the jury based on the first 14 witnesses, and Burr was acquitted.
Yeah, and it bears reading again. Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act. And there was no testimony that anyone could give saying that Burr has actually levied war against the United States or given aid and comfort to the enemies of the United States.
It could never have been that he gave aid and comfort to the an enemy of the United States because we weren't at war with anyone.
Right.
So they had to go after the levying war against the United States, and there may have been people who could give testimony that that was his intention, but they couldn't get them to testify.
Okay, so there were some witnesses out there that might have been able to testify to that, but they didn't.
Correct.
Okay. And this took about a month, you
said. Jefferson actually sent a bunch of blank pardons down to the prosecutor in Richmond and said, you can give a pardon to anybody who will testify against Burr. And the prosecutor couldn't find anyone to take them.
Wow. Even if these days, of course, we'd call that a grant of immunity.
Exactly.
Effectively, I mean, that's a fairly common tool prosecutors will use to get co-conspirators to testify against each other. But that is remarkable. Jefferson sent down a stack of signed pardons. You basically fill in the blank, pardon whoever you want to pardon, just get Burr for me.
Yeah, and it's a great letter because he says, please give offer this pardon to any respectable witness against Burr. And then in the next paragraph, he says, actually give it to anybody who'll testify against Burr. It doesn't have to be respectable.
Forget that respectable part. Oh, my goodness. All right. So apparently Jefferson has pulled out the stops. In fact, I seem to recall he was actively involved in managing the case, wasn't he? I mean, he was getting regular reports and was sending directions down to the prosecutors?
Very much. He micromanaged the case from Washington. He sent some 20 letters to the prosecutor, very detailed instructions. He told them what precedents to cite. He told them the right strategy to follow. And it's an irony because Jefferson was a wonderfully successful politician. He was no great shakes as a lawyer. And Burr, who frankly didn't win the political game, was a terrific lawyer. So, you know, once they got into the courtroom, Burr was just a lot smarter and had a lot better sense of strategy than Jefferson did.
Well, apparently that saved his neck quite literally in that circumstance. But, you know, Jefferson seems to have been misusing the crime of treason in precisely the way that the Constitution forbids. That is to get a fellow who is his political enemy any way that you can.
I think that's right. I do believe that there was evidence that might have supported a treason prosecution. For example, the statements Burr made to the British and Spanish ambassadors were very incriminating.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, they had diplomatic immunity, so they were never going to testify.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could have gotten some of the Confederates to testify, they might have made the case. But they didn't have any of that. And as a result, the case they had was not enough.
Okay, and Marshall was, if anyone was a hero in this circumstance, Marshall, I think you say in your book, was the one who stood tall here and insisted that the law be followed and that they not simply lynch Burr. No matter what his sins might have been, Marshall demanded that the evidence be brought into court, and when there was no evidence, Marshall was the one who said, we're not going to have a conviction here.
You know, that's right, and you know, this is a time, and it's hard to recreate, but you know, we have maybe 200 newspapers in the country. For about a month, every newspaper in the country runs on the front page the transcripts from Burr's trial. This is the only thing that's happening in the country that anybody is following. It is a huge issue. Nobody takes Burr's side. Everybody thinks he should be strung from the closest tree. And Marshall says, not so fast. We've got the rule of law in this country. And this evidence doesn't make it. And he really establishes that the courts are not going to get bullied by the president, they're not going to get bullied by public opinion, and that when we have legal protections, they're going to be applied. And it's a very important moment. And frankly, we need moments like that all the time. Every generation needs moments like that. But this was our first, and it was very important.
And what was the actual procedural basis on which the case of Burr was acquitted? I mean, did Marshall dismiss the charges, or did the jury dismiss the charges, or actually acquit?
No, they acquitted. Then he was tried again. There was a second trial on the Neutrality Act charges that he was going to invade Mexico. He was acquitted on that again. Then they started a third proceeding to try to arraign him and have him prosecuted out west. And this is the point at which Burr stands up and says, I believe this is the fifth time they've tried to prosecute me, and this is the question you were asking. What about double jeopardy here?
Yeah.
And it, unfortunately, you can't allege double jeopardy until the moment when charges are brought. And that's what Marshall tells them. Well, until they bring the charges, I can't stop them. So they had another evidentiary proceeding where they brought in a bunch of other evidence, some of the stuff that Marshall had not allowed them to bring in the first case.
Well, that does seem to be at least a violation of the spirit of double jeopardy, if not the actual letter of it, when you're bringing him in for essentially the same activity, simply one time under a statute, one time under a charge of treason. But that's another problematic thing here. But eventually, of course, that didn't go anywhere either, did it?
Yeah, and it just sort of died. They transferred the case out to Ohio, and Burr never went to Ohio to face the charges, and after a couple of years, the government just sort of let it go. It's a little embarrassing for the government that they were so aimless.
Well, that's actually a larger truth. It's certainly been my experience in the practice of law, and perhaps yours as well, that most cases do not end with dramatic jury verdicts and cheering courtrooms. Most cases essentially end when one side gives up.
Yeah.
And that
it worked here.
That's what happened. The government just eventually gave up. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm talking with author David Stewart about his new book, American Emperor, which chronicles the adventures of Aaron Burr after he killed Alexander Hamilton. As we've just heard, Aaron was accused of, but acquitted of, treason. But that's not the end of his adventures. In fact, stay tuned to find out what he did during his last several decades. Right now, we're going to do our Madison Minute. And then after the break, we'll talk about what's happening this week at Montpelier, and then we'll finish our discussion with David Stewart. Stay tuned.
Both James and Dolly Madison were avid gardeners. They cultivated flowering plants and fruit trees, developed formal landscapes, and tended to the plantation agriculture of Montpelier. Their great-niece, Mary Cutts, described the former president as fond of horticulture, taking particular pleasure in his twins, two tulip poplar trees on the back lawn, and picking figs and grapes from the garden. A two-week span of unseasonably warm weather in 1825 lured Dolly to her garden, where she heard birds returning from their winter migration singing their summer song. In early April of 1831, Dolly wrote of the beautiful Virginia weather, noting that the garden and grove began to charm me with music and flowers. Indeed, Dolly was so passionate about gardening that she went so far as to name the buds of her Cape Jessamine plants after her family members. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
You know that I'm the coolest that's ever come around. You notice things get hotter whenever I'm in town. I mean, I gotta be the coolest. Who else could it be? Everybody knows who's really cool. Me. It's face that I'm the greatest.
And now it's time to hear what's happening this week at Montpelier. But as regular listeners will recall, last time we spoke to Sean O'Brien, who told us how Montpelier is trying to emphasize Constitution Day and make it into a widely observed national holiday. So this time we're going to hear not so much about what's happening this week, but what our big plans at Montpelier are for this coming Constitution Day.
So you're actually going to celebrate it on Constitution Day?
Well, we won't celebrate on Constitution Day this year because it falls on a weekday.
Right.
And we want to have an all-day affair with fireworks.
Mm-hmm.
So we want people to be able to come and enjoy Montpelier for the entire day. So on Saturday, September the 22nd, we will have an all-day extravaganza at Montpelier.
Oh, boy. What's going to happen?
We're going to start out with several hundred people on horseback and in carriages arriving at Montpelier around lunchtime. They're going to ride over from Gordonsville, from Oakland Heights Farm, and come up to Montpelier through the woods. And this is something that anyone who has a horse can participate in. They just need to register and go through the process to be part
of
the ride.
So they can be part of this caravan.
They can be part of the caravan. Okay. It's a unique event to be able to ride across Chicken Mountain and come into Montpelier with this huge group of other people on horseback and in carriages. And then, so they will come in the middle of the day, and we'll have food vendors and people available. We're going to have historic reenactors available to interact with people and to play games with children. We'll have games for kids, historic games. We'll have a hayride.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the mansion will be open and available for tours all day, as is the normal thing every day of the year. And then as we get into the later afternoon, we'll start having some music. We haven't, I guess, figured out exactly which bands, but we're going to have a stage set up in front of the mansion for music. And as we get into sunset, a marine band will play patriotic music and marching tunes, which last year was just amazing. They were They're so good, these marine musicians.
They are. They are. And they look good, too.
They do. They all sit up very straight.
Right.
And their hair is perfect.
Right.
And they're just the nicest people and just amazing musicians. And they play this wonderful music. And as the sun goes down and they finish up their music and they play the Star Spangled Banner, which is a great tribute to the War of 1812.
Which happens to be 200 years ago this year.
This year, we will launch a fireworks show.
Right.
As the sun goes down. And all along we will have people serving food, and we'll have probably beer vendors and maybe some wine vendors.
Oh, you said beer.
I did.
Why didn't you say there's going to be beer there from the beginning? Okay, well now we know why we need to go.
Boy, that sounds like fun. Well, stay tuned and plan on being at Montpelier in September for Constitution Day. Thanks to Sean O'Brien for telling us what's going to be happening. Now let's finish our discussion with David Stewart, who's telling us all about Aaron Burr's big adventures.
I have to ask. I mean, Burr emerges, I won't say unscathed, but he emerges victorious from the trial of the century. But the entire country now seems to hate him. And he might even have been afraid of lynch mobs, I'm not sure. What do you do after you've been accused of treason, after you've been utterly discredited, after all your countrymen hate you and now suspect you at least and think you're treasonous, you're a traitor? What do you do?
Well, it was a hard question. He seems to have sunk into a fairly well-deserved fit of depression and then rallied from it. He was a resilient guy.
Yeah.
and came up with an even crazier plan,
okay,
which was to go to Europe and to persuade the British into bankrolling an expedition to liberate Mexico and the rest of the Spanish-American colonies, too. I mean, why not take the whole continent?
Why not?
So he goes to Britain, and he manages to get his case heard by some senior officials there, but the politics get away from him, and it's a very complicated thing in the Napoleonic Wars, but Britain ends up throwing him out of the country. He goes to Sweden, of all places, and ends up in Paris, and he tries to talk Napoleon into it. And he actually meets with Napoleon's foreign minister. I mean, he gets pretty high up. And it appears the French thought about it for, I don't know, 10 minutes, at which point they realized this is also not a good idea.
Right.
So he ends up stranded in Europe in the middle of the Napoleonic Wars, and he's there for 4 years until he finally has to sneak back into the country. He wears a disguise when he lands in the country for a couple of days just because he's not sure if, you know, people are going to, you know, arrest him on the spot. And he ultimately gets to New York, and he manages to start his new law practice. He has some terrible personal losses at that time, but he does, you know, live another 20 years.
Wait a second. Before we get to the very end of his life, I have to ask a couple of questions about that. He's trapped in France for 4 years. What is he living on? I mean, this is a guy who's not been working or drawing a salary for a long time. And he's over gallivanting around Europe. I'd like to go to Sweden. I'd like to go to Paris. But, you know, I figure I'm going to have to pay my own way. Who is paying his way?
Oh, that's a great question. Burr's finances are always tenuous. He always lived beyond his means. In Europe, he was living on a lot of borrowed money. His daughter had married a very rich man who bankrolled.
Rich son-in-law. Always a good move. All right.
Didn't hurt. But after a couple of years in Europe, he was really out of money. And he was living on nothing. And, you know, he did translation in France. He translated works. He was scrounging. He had crazy ideas for a new system for making vinegar. He tried to sell that. He had a scheme for a new form of steamboat. That was all the rage at that time. That was the technological marvel.
Mm-hmm.
And he really, you know, was sort of, living in a garret apartment without enough money to buy firewood. I mean, he writes in his diary. He keeps a wonderful diary when he's in Europe. And he writes in his diary the temperature of his room. But, you know, and he wakes up and it's 46 degrees. It'd be a little frosty.
A little bit frosty, yeah. Well, you know, that's the funny thing is that on the one hand, these schemes seem utterly ridiculous, and he actually is starting to sound utterly ridiculous at this point. You can see why the Britons kicked him out and why the French wouldn't treat him seriously because, you know, he's starting to sound a little bit like the crazy guy. There's Aaron Burr, you know, there's all the little children laughing at him as he walks down the street. On the other hand, the idea of going to a powerful country like Britain or France and saying, hey, you've got this colonial rival over here and they've got this empire and it's ripe for the picking, and if you just give me a few ships and some money, I'll go over there and take them out for you. You could see that in the right circumstances, either Britain or France might well have gone for such a scheme. So it's not quite as ridiculous as it may seem to us now.
I think that's fair. He was unlucky in a couple of things. The British had the Navy, so they were the best people to make the deal with. And it just so happened when he gets to Britain, there's been a change. Napoleon has just invaded Spain, and he has turned Spain from an ally of France into an adversary.
Hmm.
There are these Spanish juntas arise in different cities, and they ally themselves with Britain. And suddenly Britain is on Spain's side, and so they don't want to take over Spain's colonies in America anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was just a pivot that happened right when he got there. And so that was bad luck.
Right.
When he gets to France, by the time he gets there, frankly, the French would love to, you know, since Spain's now on the other side, they'd love to have the Spanish colonies liberated. But they don't have a navy to get them over there. I mean, it's just not practical. So,
and they're a bit distracted by what's happening right there on the continent, too. Yeah, well,
Napoleon was busy.
He was busy. In fact, that's one of the reasons he got rid of Louisiana, a little bit earlier than that, because
right.
he was preoccupied with what was happening in Europe. But I'm even reminded of the infamous Zimmerman telegram, 100 years later. If you recall, during World War I, there was a big scandal because the Germans were trying to foment anti-American sentiment in Mexico. And so it's, again, even that late, even 100 years later, there were European powers who were trying to mess around in Mexico at the very least and use them for their own political purposes. So, there is an element of realpolitik here that might very well have gone forward if Burr had been a bit luckier than he was.
Fair enough.
Okay. Now, he goes back to United States, and this is the other thing I had to ask you about. You said he started practicing law. You can't tell me that through all of this he still has his bar license in New York.
Terrific question. It doesn't seem to have been a problem.
Man.
The disciplinary mechanisms were not too finely honed.
Right.
The interesting thing is he had been indicted for murder after the duel with Hamilton, and something happened to those murder charges. Because he's not prosecuted for murder.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that he was indicted also in New Jersey, and we know those were quashed. There is a court record for that. He was indicted in New York, and there is no record of whether they were quashed or not, but clearly he continued to live there for another 20-some years, so nobody was trying to prosecute him.
I think the problem in New York might have been related to the very reason that he went to Weehawken, New Jersey for the duel. Because that, in fact, a lot of people use those very dueling grounds. A lot of people from New York did because they didn't want to be charged with murder in New York State. So maybe that was really just the basic problem, is that New York really wasn't in a position to prosecute him for a murder that didn't happen on New York territory.
That's right. It was a bogus charge. They could have prosecuted him for violating their dueling law. There were things, but, the world had passed them by.
Mm-hmm.
He gets back at the end of 1812. It's more than 8 years ago that the duel happened. So, and we're in the middle of the War of 1812. We're just, getting into it. So it's not the time, and it doesn't happen.
Okay, so he's back in New York. You say he lives for another 20 years. How does he fill his final decades?
Well, he's got a lot of debts he tries to pay off. And he sets up a house. He takes in stray kids. It's widely thought that at least a couple of them were his own illegitimate children. He had been a single gentleman, a widower, since the age of 37, and he was very popular with the ladies. So this is not a great surprise. And he raises these children, including a couple of daughters of a client of his who had been defrauded and lost all her money, and he raised the daughters and married them off to fine gentlemen. He put one of the boys, he got him an appointment to West Point. He set the other one up in business. I mean, he really becomes quite domestic. In his rather advanced years, he's 78, he remarries. He marries the richest widow in New York. He's still Aaron Burr.
This guy never gives up. He just never gives up. He's got an angle for everything, doesn't he?
He's got to sort of hand it to him. And the marriage does not go well. His wife throws him out after 6 months and claims that he stole all her money and he's been making it with the maid. And
he's 78 years old.
Well, he's a man to emulate. And he has counter charges. They end up in a divorce proceeding, and which was sort of a big deal back in 1835. And the divorce, it's sort of poignant. The divorce decree comes through on the day he dies.
Oh. Well, speaking of death, there was one tragedy I think you were about to talk about, and I think I rudely interrupted you. He had a beloved daughter, didn't he? And he lost the daughter.
Yes, he had one legitimate child, right. Theodosia.
Theodosia.
And he had raised
okay.
her with great dedication, had her educated the way a young man would have been educated. And by all accounts, she was just a remarkable person, just smart, witty, vivacious.
And that unusual name came from her mother. Her mother was also Theodosia, wasn't she?
Yes. That was more of a practice in those days to repeat the female name as well.
Mm-hmm.
She was
his helpmate. She actually sort of served as a political wife stand-in, didn't she?
Well, she did some social duties, but actually she married quite young. She was 17 when she married this fellow from South Carolina who was, in fact, an aspiring politician. He was the richest man in South Carolina.
Oh, okay.
And became governor of South Carolina. So, you know, she performed these functions for both of them, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And she was ill. She had what may well have been some sort of cervical cancer, because that's what her mother seems to have died of as well at an untimely age. So when Burr is coming back from Europe, when he gets to New York, and she has one child, but because of her illness, she can't have more than one. And the child is named Aaron Burr Alston after him. And it's, of course, the apple of his eye, of Burr's eye. And when he gets back to New York, he gets the word that his grandson has died of a fever at the age of 11.
Mm.
And this is a terrible blow. And he writes a letter to Theodosia saying, "You must come to New York. I must see you. I can't stand this." And he sends a man to South Carolina to escort her to New York, always being proper. And Theodosia and this man get on a ship. It's actually on New Year's Eve on 1812, and the ship is never seen again.
Mm.
And there is a legend that, you know, for weeks and then months, Burr would go down to the piers in Manhattan and pace the piers looking for the ship, waiting for Theodosia's ship, and it never comes in. And he's just bereft. He actually writes to his son-in-law that he is severed from the human race. It's a very sad moment.
Indeed it is. Well, a sad end for a very colorful character. In fact, perhaps the most colorful character in American history.
He's close.
And that's our show. And wasn't that a fascinating discussion with author David Stewart, who's written this marvelous book called American Emperor, all about Aaron Burr and his adventures after he shot and killed Alexander Hamilton? I thought that was just a fascinating interview, and I enjoyed the heck out of it. Before we go, though, I'd like to remind you that we're all over the Internet, so please Google us, and you can find us on iTunes and download podcasts, and you can find our Facebook page and become a fan. You can Twitter with us on Twitter. You can do all sorts of interesting things online with your weekly Constitutional. So Google us. And welcome to our newest station in your weekly Constitutional family, WPRR in Grand Rapids Public Reality Radio. Hello, all you Western Michiganders. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.